Hello, and welcome back to Slut PhD. I'm your host, Julie Fennell, and today I am back with my partner, Sugar and Poison, and we're going to be talking about foundations of gender and sexual attraction. There's going to be some kind of speculative, sociological, psychological meanderings.
A little bit of analysis, a little bit of personal analysis.
Well, yeah, I don't think there's probably much in the way of trigger warnings for this episode. I would recommend, if you have not yet listened to a previous episode called Born This Way, that you might want to listen to that before this episode, because this in a lot of ways is sort of a follow-up. I do want to quickly review some of the key points about gender and sexual orientation that were made, that I made in that previous episode, which was with Doug Robinson. One is just the simple sociological fact of differentiating sexual identity, orientation, and attraction. And sexual identity is how you label yourself, your own feet, like of gay, straight, bi, whatever. And that's how you feel in your own head and your own experience. And then sexual orientation is kind of what society tells you, and it also implies an idea of born this way. Because the term orientation really suggests that this is something that's fixed about you that cannot change, whereas the concept of sexual identity is intended to be a bit more flexible than that, implying things like, well, you could be bisexual, but choose to identify as straight or lesbian, right? And then the last one there is sexual attraction, which is based on what it is that you are attracted to, and not with reference to any of these socially made up labels. And one of the big points I made in that episode was suggesting that maybe people aren't necessarily born this way in terms of sexual quote unquote orientation, and that maybe that doesn't matter. That we could, in fact, come to be the things that we are in terms of sexual attraction and experience for a wide variety of reasons, and that it is highly politically motivated to say that we're born this way, and there's like some facts to back that up, but not as many as you might think, especially when you're talking about people assigned female at birth. Another point that I made in that episode was that organizing sexual orientation as groups of related fetishes, rather than assuming everything is about gender slash sex, gender being more of the social element of things, sex being more of the biological element of the thing, might help us a lot in terms of our conceptualization and conversations, and, you know, help people talk about, I have a fetish for vaginas, or I have a fetish for penises, or I have a fetish for secondary feminine characteristics, I have a fetish for deep voices, right? Like whatever the thing is that somebody is into, rather than saying, oh, that makes you straight or that makes you gay, you can organize things that way, and that might help us in terms of understanding that and having these social conversations. And I really don't think that the current system seems to be particularly great for categorizing many people's sexual experiences, including my own. Also relevant in that conversation, I introduced the term gray sexual, which Sugar and Poison, I think, is in that complicated category.
Yeah, so I would say, I think in terms of my relationship with sexuality, certainly there's an argument to be made toward some form of gray sexuality. I would say this is one of those areas where, you know, it's complicated to them, right? And I generally, historically, did not consider myself ace or gray ace. And I think that there's an element of that that comes down to sex being kind of a special interest of mine in a way that is separate from the way that, like, a lot of people feel the desire to engage in it. And so I enjoy sex as a form of play in a way that's a little bit, I think, in a different emotional grid area
Yeah.
than like a lot of people's relationship with sex sits.
Well, I also feel like you are more defined by your interest in sadism in a lot of ways than by your interest in sex, potentially.
Depends. I would say I think I am more defined by generally just the modalities in which I enjoy relating to people than the interest in sex with them. And sadism is definitely one of the things that falls into that bucket, right? And when I say like, oh, like I'm, the ways that I like to relate to people, I don't mean in the way that people mean typically when they say they're like demi, right? I'm not like, ah, I need to trust you. There's a lot to unpack around, like, what do we experience as the draw of other people? Actually, this might be a good
It's a
segue
segue. Well, it's part of
into.
why I figured talking about your experience was kind of the segue here in a lot of ways, because I think your interest in people, you talked in a previous episode that we did about your enthusiasm for the concept of drive-by sadism, like your willingness to consensually hurt strangers. And that's really, I think, telling and separate from, people who are willing to have sex with strangers.
Oh yeah, I generally am not interested. Well, okay, so there's a scale, right, of how interested you are in casual sex. And I have had and enjoyed what I would consider to be casual sex. That being said, I have been involved with some real S-tier sluts. And
S-tier?
yeah, and so like for example, I have an ex who I'm quite fond of, and one time he turned to me and he was like, "You're not into casual sex." And I was like, "What do you mean?" Because I do, in fact, sometimes have casual sex. And he was like, "Well, nobody's gonna spend less than 4 hours with you and end up having sex with you." And I was like, first of all, that's a pretty aggressive bar for casual sex. But then I actually had a follow-up conversation with another friend who I'm quite close with. And he was like, "Actually, I think there is a way someone could do this with you." And he was like, "The trick is, you would have to be at a party. They would have to circulate to you, work up like a bunch of sexual tension, disappear, and then like repeat that several times over the course of the night." And I
That's
was like, you know
amazing.
what? That is an accurate read to filth, like just clocked the fuck out in
Nice.
terms of like what it would take, right? But the element of interest there is really not around fucking a stranger. It's around fucking an intriguing person. And so it's like, what's the fastest that someone could hit that benchmark?
I feel like hypothetically, I'm pretty willing to have sex one-on-one with strangers, but I can't tolerate the social expectations around that. And so I won't really do it in practice. I don't hardly ever have. I do it a lot in the context of group sex, as I discussed in an earlier episode, but the lovely thing about group sex is that you're not expected to talk to somebody. It's the opposite of the thing you just described, right? There's no expectation of 4 hours of chatting. And so to me, the dreaded part of casual sex is having to talk to a stranger for 4 hours.
Interesting, interesting.
It's not the having sex with a stranger that's troubling. It's the having to talk with them before and after, and also the fear of being bored, right? Like, the how do I get out of this situation if I am bored, which I frequently am if I talk to strangers, which is a pretty neurodivergent thing to say out loud, but here we have
Yeah,
it.
I mean, I think, well, I don't want to say we've all been there.
I don't think.
But like many of us have been some version of there.
So, I mean, when we were talking about this the other night, we started talking about all of these elements and how incredibly complex and layered that this comes down to, right? And just the dimensions of the thing that we were just talking about in terms of buildup and sexual tension and, is the thing that drives you the chatting with somebody, or is it something else, right? And I hear so many people in Kinkland, especially, who obsess over this word connection, and I often get really snarky about it, especially in rope land and the way a lot of rope people like to use it. But there is something ineffable there that I guess a lot of the people who try to science this have tried to do with pheromones,
yeah.
right? Looking for this point of what creates a feeling of spark.
Yeah,
and for me, it's largely some combination, personally, right? It's largely some combination of like, do I think that you are smart, interesting, and smell good, and we have vaguely aligned kinks?
Mm-hmm.
And that's like the things that I personally prioritize. And one of my problems with standard mating rituals is they do not include a moment of smelling somebody's armpits.
Interesting.
Well, this is part of why I like doing rope with people, because
you can get in real close.
I can get in real close, which is extra funny because there's this ancient, hilarious stereotype of rigor sniff,
mm-hmm.
which is where like riggers have this move where they like smell the rope bottom, and this is like highly mocked thing
yeah.
in rope culture. And that's not actually what I'm into per se. What I am actually specifically into, and it gets even weirder than how somebody smells, is how do you smell when you are aroused by me personally?
Interesting.
And my sense of smell is so precise that I even care about the difference about you being aroused by me versus
mm-hmm.
somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's the thing that I know I'm looking for, in addition to the, like, are you smart and do our kinks align thing. And that's my personal version of connection. But I think one of the things that people really tend to miss, even in Kinkland in these conversations, is we have radically different visions, all of us, individually, about what connection looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So yours is...
So I would say so that it can take a few forms, right?
Yeah.
And so a couple of concepts to flay out that I think are useful here in terms of how I think about attraction, my own attraction and other people's attractions, and just kind of like a couple of different scales that I tend to think about people on. One is, in my experience, there is a useful sort of semi-binary distinction to be made between, in the process of building tension all the way to getting off, whether people enjoy more the buildup of tension or like the moment of release.
Oh, yeah.
And so I would say that I'm one of those people who really enjoys that buildup of tension more than getting off, even though like I'm actually quite easy to get off.
No, I think that's common. I think that the two groups of people who are the most likely to feel that way are the people who are easy to get off and hard to get off.
Yeah, like, I agree. Where like if you are someone who it's easy to get off, or who has an easy time getting laid sometimes, depending,
yeah.
right? Like, you may be someone who, like, finds the process to be the more interesting element of it.
Yeah.
Whereas if that's either something that's harder for you to do and requires specific contributions from a partner
yeah.
or, like, conditions to be met, then, like, it may be the case that what's in shorter supply or what's more exciting is like the moment of getting off.
Yeah, yeah. I had an ex-girlfriend who was a total slut and loved sex and was absolutely incapable of making herself orgasm.
And
she was ridiculously easy to
mm-hmm.
make come
mm-hmm.
if you were someone else doing this to her, but she could not make herself come. And so it just made her such a slut, which was really fun
That's
and entertaining, funny. But like it meant that she was chasing the getting off
yeah.
part because it wasn't something that she could do for herself.
Yeah. And there's an element of that's not just about orgasm, right? Like when
yeah.
we talked about the femdom, when we did the femdom podcast, something that I think I might have mentioned then, which we've talked about before, is that for me, if someone shows up in an interaction with me and they are already highly submissive in their behavior, that's actually quite unappealing.
They're pre-conquered for you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like the food has already been eaten. Like, you know, you what's the point now? I don't get to put you on your knees, right? Like, and I think that feeling about the process is true both of my orientation in DS and of my orientation sort of sexually toward sex, let's say.
The interesting part of the story is the buildup for you.
Exactly, exactly. And how it happens. And actually, I would say for me, right, that is where the meaningful exercise of power occurs in DS, is where you're actually acquiring the ability through interaction to exert leverage, right, like over the person in front of you versus like, I'm about to say something that I don't think it's quite get me canceled level, but might be a little bit controversial. I think when we want to make people feel very safe about BDSM who are not experienced with BDSM, there's a thing that people like to say, which is like, well, the bottom or the sub has all
All the
the power.
power. Yeah.
And like, that's actually not how it works. And I don't mean to say the top has all the power, but power is a real thing that exists. It doesn't just exist where you assign it. So, in a relationship where one partner is way more invested than the other,
Yes.
the less invested person has power. And that could be the top or that could be the bottom. Now, I'm not implying that this is how I feel about these interactions I'm describing, but it's an example of a situation where power just exists, regardless of
Yeah.
what either of you claims its position is. And so, what I enjoy about power dynamics is exploring the actual exercise
Yeah.
of power, and how it builds and how it manifests. And when it comes to interacting with new people, it's like, there's a process of discovery and figuring out what someone's like and what they'll react to.
Yeah. Well, I think some of what we're talking about here that tends to just fly over so many of these conversations that we have culturally, because I think most of the knowledge that we have as a culture about this is literally from the 1950s. I was reading about Kenzie again the other day, which I'm not sure when I'll be doing this podcast. It might be before or after, and talking about famous bisexuals and poly folks. Kinsey's great at what he did, but the fact that our cultural technology for having these conversations hasn't really progressed that much since 1950 blows my mind. And in a lot of ways, what we got from Kinsey was like three bi poly dudes' version of what sexuality looks like. And I have a little bit, when I look at the way that our current understanding of sex is, it feels like a joke that we often talk about in social science, like, we generalized from men to everybody, from cis men to everybody, is a little bit what happened. And so, in later, more sophisticated versions of Kinsey's type of division, right, we started to separate out the idea of romantic attraction from sexual attraction, which is helpful, but still, in a lot of ways, I don't think quite covers the basis, right? And so we're still flailing in a lot of ways to figure out what it is that's actually going on here when people talk about what it is that they're looking for. And so some of what we're talking about is emotional attraction, and some of what we're talking about is physical attraction, and some of what we're talking about might possibly be something we haven't even fully named yet.
So to that point, something we've talked about before is I'm a little old for it, but had I been a youth in today's climate, right, in my teens, I might have described myself as ace, as fully ace at that time. And I've thought a lot about how that turned out. And this is very much not a situation where I'm looking to claim that anyone who feels ace and is younger is not or is invalid in their identity, but just to speak about my own experience. And
Well,
I
also, I
think.
think to speak to the fact that we are, again, part of the thing that was often unsophisticated in this conversation is the assumption that you have an orientation and it stays the same. And actually, maybe you were ace then, right? Like that is an available possibility that we should consider.
And well, so just to kind of speak to my experience of getting from a place where I was what I would consider to be ace to a place where I would consider to be not ace, perhaps gray ace, right? Like, so here's my experience as an adult, like out in the world, it seems to me, both from my own experience and from observing the experiences of others, that there's really more than one kind of attraction. And there's sort of one that's considered classical physical or sexual attraction, which is where you look at someone or something and it gives you the urge to do downstairs activities, right? Like simple see thing, wanna do
Won't
thing.
fuck, yeah.
Exactly. Like see hottie, want fuck, right?
Yeah.
And I think that that is real and that exists and that people of all genders experience that. But I think there is another variety of attraction, at least one, but one in particular I'm thinking of that we experience a lot and it tends to have less of a name. It's an emotion that we are not really taught a name for. And this is attraction in the sense of like gravity, where when you are around someone, you want to be closer to them.
Yeah.
And this is not, I think, inherently experienced as sexual, necessarily, right? So you Find someone magnetic.
Yeah.
When they're in a room, you want to be talking to them. If you're talking to them, you want to be sitting with them. If you're sitting with them, you want to be touching them. And like, there's this desire to be a little bit closer than you currently are, right? And for me, I would say, certainly for a long time, and maybe even now, that's the primary way I experience attraction. And it took until I started having sex with people, and in fact, good sex, for that to be mentally wired to sex at all, right? Like that had to eventually reach a place where all that becoming more proximal achieved orgasms, right? Like for me to even think, oh, like I'm attracted when I feel that way. And my observation about this, right, has been, while neither of these is strictly gendered, there is a bias, right? Like I think people who, I'm gonna say, have higher levels of male sex hormones, right, experience that visual pop maybe a little bit more intensely or more frequently. And people who, are working with another hormone stack, right, maybe have a little bit more bias in this other direction. That being said, I don't think it's as clear cut as one or the other. I think actually, like, something that I've found really fascinating as like a person who's not super conventional looking. I'm not like, I'm not bad looking, but like I am one of those people who like, I'm some people's not so hot and some people's very hot, right? Like that kind of look. I think that even men are more subject to this sort of magnetic and charismatic attraction than they are socialized to believe they are.
My personal opinion, not research based at all, my personal opinion is that men seem, at least in my mind, to be more prone to believing that if a woman is conventionally hot, then they should be attracted to her. And whereas, women, I think, are often more attracted to men for social status. And I believe that is based on. There's some of that might actually be based on real numbers, but what really goes on, and I'll talk to men about this, they are unpleasantly surprised to find that they've hooked up with a hot girl and the sex wasn't that great. And they are surprised by that. And I feel like women are less surprised if they hook up with a pretty boy who's bad in bed. Like women seem to understand that these things maybe aren't actually connected. And I know that there have been some studies that have been done that show that men don't have a great concept of how women could be good in bed. Like the reality is that they definitely do have one, but like in terms of their own concept, straight men, I think in particular,
Well, I think,
don't.
in terms of how straight men are socialized to view having sex with conventionally attractive women, right? There's a big element of man-on-man status assessment happening there. And I think that there is a projection or like a sort of dream that men are led to buy into that when the things that give you high status with other men occur, you will feel good and be fulfilled. And so, you see this in other areas of life, but in the area of sleeping with hotties, right? Like, it's like, oh, if I sleep with a woman who other men find desirable, that will be the good sex.
I mean, I should say while I'm like sort of, I sound like I maybe am like mocking straight men about this. I hasten to add that for myself personally, I often feel like my sexual orientation is partly defined by how deeply mediocre I am at knowing who I am attracted to until I have sex with them. And I have had plenty of years. I ought to have been able to figure it out by now. But like, I really am not great at discerning this in advance. And I think some of it is a smell thing, because how do you know if your attraction is so highly determined by how somebody smells when they're aroused by you? Well, how would you know that until you were there? But you'd think after doing as much of it as I have that I would be better at predicting. But I would say, especially when it comes to like top tier sex partners of mine, I have not been great at predicting in advance who would land in the top tier. And I'm pretty good at ditching people out, I think, although there's a bias there because I didn't fuck them, so who knows? But I no, actually, a couple times I intentionally did have sex with people where I was doubtful, were pretty doubtful, and it was bad. So I was like, great, I have confirmed that, moving on. But I think it suggests to me that
whatever it is that draws me and possibly lots of other people, it's not necessarily how somebody looks, and it's not necessarily even the things that maybe I think it is, and maybe it's something else. But I am really interested when I talk, especially to men, because I feel like I have more conversations with men about this, where they sound confused about how mediocre the sex was with someone who they thought was attractive. And I can't tell if women just are used to having mediocre sex with men, and so they're not surprised, or if they're better at picking guys for whatever reason. I also only hang out with kinky people, so.
I would also say, when you talk about women versus men in this capacity, women are more likely to have a positively connoted peer review system
Yeah, I was thinking
for
that as soon as I said
sex.
it.
Yeah. And like, I think this plays into, some guys getting laid a lot, right? Where if you provide a discrete positive experience for one woman and, and for whatever reason, you're not lockdown material in any, monogamous sense, mutually, she will generally recommend you to
Friends.
friends who are looking for a good time.
To be fair, I think this mostly ends up applying in our extremely queer and pretty open.
I
You think it
don't,
happens in
no, it
non-monogamous
definitely
people
happens
too?
among people who are not. Yeah, no, I mean,
Fascinating.
I would say I quote unquote observed this
Oh,
phenomenon
oh.
primarily outside of the kink community when I
Huh.
was in college.
All right.
And since it's a bit less of a thing or a bit less relevant because I think a lot more people interested in casual sex have moved to the apps.
Yeah.
Although I suspect having a substantially worse experience
Well, I
continues
also
now.
think people are having way less sex off those
That's
apps
fair. That's fair.
than we think they are. There's also that.
But yeah, whereas like I've been in a lot of rooms where some locker room talk was happening, and while guys will talk about whether a woman is good in bed, it generally will not be in the sense of complimenting her in a way that is talking her up to another dude as a recommendation positively,
Yeah,
right?
no.
Like it's just that's just not is not considered to be like a respectable good deed she is doing
Yeah.
for the community.
Oh, no, that's really fair.
So my experience with this actually has been there is a curve with a long tail on it, right, that operates
Phrasing.
here where guys who, I genuinely don't mean this in a mean way, but guys who have not gotten a lot of play assume that they should be aiming to sleep with hot girls.
Yeah.
And then guys who have gotten around a bit more have had a variety of experiences with people with a variety of different looks to them and have learned that
Yeah.
that's not always going to be the best experience for them, and so are open potentially to a little more variety when they see people who have qualities that interest them. I remember a conversation at one point with, in fact, someone who I was just thinking of when I was talking about the recommendation system, who is a former partner of mine. And relatively early on, he sort of told me where I ranked in the number of people who had ever given him blowjobs. And I was
Okay.
like, oh, that's nice, right? And the first time he told it to me, it was like in the top five. And I was like, well, that's nice. But I didn't realize at the time how many people he had received blowjobs from. And then it was like a triple digit number,
Oh,
right?
wow.
Yeah. So later on, I had a conversation with him and in which I was like, okay, you've gotten a lot of head in your life from a lot of different people. Like, what quality would you say is most predictive of whether someone is going to give good
Oh,
head,
interesting.
right? And his answer, which I think was kind of incredible, was he was like, a desire to pursue excellence in every area of life.
I love this
This
so
is what he's
much.
looking for. He's looking for people who are
Oh
like
my God.
driven to excellence.
So real. It just explains so much about why nerds are so much better at sex in general.
I can't speak to that, but it was like a fascinating answer
I mean,
that
no,
was
I mean,
not what I was expecting.
no, I mean, as I recall, I saw at least like one study, I think, that was claiming that there genuinely was a connection between being smarter and being better at sex. This is very hard to measure, so I can't remember how they were operationalizing this.
But it's certainly been my own experience of the thing, and it makes a lot of sense if you are trying real hard, then
If you are really interested
yeah,
in
committed to the thing.
If your mother didn't raise a bitch and you're not gonna quit before you do a good job, like maybe that's gonna work out long term. It's a skills building exercise, right?
Well, I think though, to bring us back to like this origins of sexual orientation or whatever the fuck we want to call that thing that is who we're attracted to, I think we're coming up against this bizarre amalgamation of drawn to somebody versus what happens when you do something with them. And there can be a bit of a gap in there. And you know, there are some people who I keep around in my life just because I continue to be drawn to them, even if the sex isn't amazing, or usually it's
Well,
because the kink's really good.
I think there's also an element. Actually, I think this also plays into some of the stuff we were talking about earlier with people hooking up with hot people and then being confused why the sex isn't good, right? I think we have an assumption that the quality of the sex that you have with someone is going to be an outcome of how attracted you are to them and what their level of technical skill and enthusiasm is. And that leaves out an entire quality that I think is very important, which is like, for better or worse, it can actually go in either direction, but how safe do you feel in this interaction? And I think you see this in particular with men in group sex situations, where like, someone may think in theory they're going to be really into a group sex situation. They may find everyone involved in it really attractive, but it's pretty common when like the pedal hits the metal for dicks not to work. And I put that to a lack of a sense of safety
Interesting.
and like to some extent trust in that interaction. And you hear people talk about, oh, like I need to trust someone, or I need to be comfortable with them, or I need to feel close to them, or intimate with them, or connected in order to have sex. And I think some of that does come down, right, to a sense of safety, a sense of trust. And I think it's more universal than we like to think, except in the cases where the fetish is for the opposite.
I mean, that's why I'm constantly amazed that there are apparently people who are willing to hook up with strangers from apps. Like, it is hard for me to imagine feeling that level of comfort and safety. And sure, I've had sex with strangers, but they were in public places at kink events. And, you know, at least it provides the illusion of safety there. I mean, one can argue about how safe it actually is, but there's a fair amount of pseudo vetting that has gone on. At the very least, somebody has checked their ID. And like, there's a lot of people around that I theoretically might do something if I screamed loudly. But what's going to happen if you just show up at somebody's house? That's too much for me. And I guess it's not for some people. But I think when you're talking about like where you land, I think there are other people for whom those other people being around is the place where they don't feel safe, ergo like the group sex situation, right? Where like the feeling of unsafety comes from being on display or having too many people watching or like anything like that. And for me, that's what provides a fair bit of security. And so what it is that gives you security, I think you're right, is huge in terms of manifesting your willingness to actually put out, regardless of how attracted you are to somebody.
Well, and also factors into the literal quality of the orgasms and how in your body you can be. And maybe that's like, maybe I experience that a bit more so because I'm kind of a cerebral person, right? But I do find, for better or worse, this isn't even like, oh, I better trust you or I'm not going to have sex with you. But like the quality of my ability to be in the moment in my body does have a relationship with how I assess the person who I'm engaged with, right? Like, and not just whether I think they're hot, not just whether I like them, not just whether we're connected, but like how I feel like things are gonna go, how much I feel like I understand why they're here, how much I feel confident that the follow-up to the encounter is gonna be handled in a way that's like socially graceful, like all of these things I think feed into the quality of the sex and like maybe are separate from attraction per se, but also like are an element that we ignore except in the context of implying that sex needs to happen in an intimate relationship.
Right.
And I think that they are relevant in circumstances other than that as well.
Yeah, I mean, we gotta keep in mind when we talk about something like the Kinsey scale, especially this is developed in a context where the vast majority of sex was occurring in the context of engagement or marriage, and mostly marriage, right? And it's that is a context where a pretty intense level of relationship commitment is understood, assumed, and accepted.
Yeah.
And nowadays, the way we're doing sex is much less that thing. I'm sure statistically, last I checked, the majority of sex is still occurring. You know, if you count up the number of sex acts, the majority of them are still occurring in relationships. But you know, there's still a question of like, but what makes you feel safe? And it's also really interesting to me that as a culture, we've started to expect people to have more casual sex than we used to, for sure. I mean,
Yeah.
it used to be you were expected to have none. And now lots of people at least have one or two casual encounters in the course of their lives. And so, and by casual sex, I'm using kind of a classic sociological definition here, usually of like less than three dates, basically, because three dates is still kind of the standard. And frequently, you know, one. Right? And so as people have been doing that more and have built up greater social pressure to have that, I think it changes our concept of what a relationship and an intimacy in the context of a relationship looks like. But I will say it's been pretty rare in my adult dating life that I've held hands with somebody before I had sex with them. And that was
Interesting.
certainly part of, you know, the traditional way that that was supposed to go. And I've seen numbers saying that that's become increasingly common, of like
Interesting.
people have sex and then have relationships rather than having relationships and then having sex. And I think one of the points of tension or confusion or however we want to frame that that's going on there is I think lots of people still would rather have a relationship and then have sex.
Yeah.
And I think that's totally normal.
Yeah.
And we haven't named that as like a thing.
Yeah. I
And
think a lot of
you
people who feel that way end up bucketing themselves as
yeah.
demisexual, which
Yeah.
is a little tricky because I do, you know, it's a valid sexual identity, but I suspect it's also a majority sexual identity.
Exactly.
I think, you know, particularly if you were to take the bias out of maybe guys tending to overreport their interest in casual sex
Vastly
relative to
overreport it.
How they actually respond to that situation. You know, but even among women, you know, I think that the way that people talk about wanting to feel connected before having sex, it's as though everyone else doesn't feel that way.
Right.
And in my experience, the majority of people, even people who come at it a little sideways, like I do sometimes,
And me
where what I'm
too.
looking for is not necessarily romantic attraction, right?
Yeah.
Like, generally, people want context to exist.
Yeah.
And if they don't want context to exist, that's the whole point, and it's a kink.
That's true. I would absolutely agree with both of those things. I much prefer having sex with people who I feel connected to on some level, and usually if it was any good, I prefer to keep doing it. I'm always fascinated by
Yeah.
people I talk to who have a thing for one night stands. I've talked to several.
Same. For me, it's like either we've had bad sex and
Right.
the op was a failure. This was not a nice, clean op, right? Like,
Yeah.
or we've had good sex, in which case I want to do it again.
Exactly, because chances are it'll get better. You start if it was good the first
Yeah.
time, it usually gets better from there. I've never had, that's not true. One time, one person have I ever had it decay. But like
Interesting.
one person in a fairly extensive sexual history, that's it. And
Yeah.
otherwise, it only decayed because of relationships falling apart, not
Yeah.
because the sex got worse on its own. And usually, almost everyone I've ever had sex with, it either stayed the same or it got better. And so it's like, why would you want to not? I mean, granted, again, I've got a certain bias there because I didn't keep having sex with people who it was
Yeah,
bad.
yeah, yeah.
Although, again, early on, because I was a very scientific slut, I did keep having sex with a couple people with whom I had bad sex. So, like, does it get better?
Yeah.
The answer was no. I kept
Yeah.
trying.
I am trying to, you know, I've had sex with people who I had really good kink chemistry with
Yeah.
and not good sexual
Yeah.
chemistry with,
For sure.
and that's not necessarily not worthwhile, right?
Right.
Like, that's something
I'm not,
where,
that's against its own category for me
yeah.
because, like, if the kink is good enough, do I care whether or not the sex was that great? I can go jerk off later,
Yeah,
right? Like,
exactly. It's like I can go diddle myself and like we will be fine, but like I can't DS myself.
Nope.
So, you know.
Hashtag priorities.
Yeah.
I can't step on myself. Most importantly, I can't effectively control my own orgasm. I can jerk myself off, but I cannot kink myself very well,
I mean,
so.
you can fantasize, you can write fiction,
Yep,
but
yep.
it's not experiential in the same way that masturbating is,
Yeah.
really. Like,
Yeah. So the last thing we had talked about with regards to all of this was some of the really nebulous things about gender and how much possibly our own really inadequate visions of gender continues to inform further inadequate visions of sexual identity, orientation, and attraction. And in particular, the way that gender itself can, pun, engender feelings of closeness or not between people, right? And so, for example, when we were initially chatting about this, I was talking about how I often joke that I'm not sure it's even a joke that I have like a gay man's brain that was like implanted into a body that is completely not a gay man's body. And in the same way that the comedian John Mulaney has complained that he feels like he was assembly lined as a human with like being a gay man, and then they failed to just make him gay. And I often feel like it's like, well, it's like, well, let's just mix this around. Like, let's put a gay man's brain in this like fairly femme body. Like, what'll happen there? And because we don't usually think of those things as being distinct, we expect them to present as a whole, then it becomes more difficult for us to accurately kind of gauge somebody's gender. And someone like me gets read as, to quote one of my dear friends who hopefully will be on this podcast eventually, an alien. Because, well, it doesn't clock as trans. And I think, I mean, I mostly get read as pretty queer, but.
I mean, my own gender presentation is I'm a cis woman. I am more or less femme, but I definitely read as queer and femme gender non-conforming in ways that read not as masculine, but as slightly sinister.
Yeah, we've talked about this in our femdom episode about being villain coded.
Like definitely a little bit villain coded gender-wise, in kind of like an ice queen sort of way.
Yeah.
And I think that comes from a bunch of different places, but it does get into a zone where you're talking about, all right, well, gender presentation is not as simple as obviously as people like to think, and we were talking earlier about how, you have a sub man partner
Yes.
who frequently has projected onto him that he is secretly or an egg of trans femme,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And this is not the case for him. And in fact, he's
Probably.
probably,
He's on his reserves and
to
assets
the
on this
best of our
one.
knowledge
Yes.
and his, it is not true of him. And in fact, like what he thinks is happening there, or what you think is happening there, is that sub man attributes are being interpreted as feminine.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a large degree to which I think dominant woman gets read as more masculine. And so in these types of interactions, as you look for different things, gender sometimes is a fun element in this dance, but it is just one element, and it can also get in your way, right? Because if the thing that you're looking for is, I don't know, defiance, right? Like, you're already going to be complicating. This is already going to be more queer, right? But the other another reason why this came up as we were chatting is I recently read an academic paper by the amazing scholar Joel Mittleman, Mittelman, who I probably will not link to in this episode at this point just because people are so under attack in my discipline. But his a great paper where he, that is publicly accessible. Where he's talking, analyzing, they're actually from 2009, they're high schoolers, and he's got straight, gay, lesbian, and bisexual high school students. He's not divided, but by gender. And he has a question from the survey of basically like, how do you think other people perceive your gender? It's like very masculine. It goes like very masculine, very feminine. And then he has a bunch of other questions from which he then is able to determine the degree to which you do, in fact, conform to not pre-expected ideas of gender, but like the actual ones based on people's behavior. Like, do you play video games a lot and do you play sports and that kind of thing? And one of the things that really stood out to me in that was that both, I think, bisexuals and much more so gay boys, but also to a lesser degree, lesbians, perceive themselves to be perceived as more gender non-conforming than they actually are, which is a wild idea. It's like you have internalized this concept as a queer person that you are less gender conforming than you actually are, which I think is really interesting that we have that feeling about ourselves as queer people. And I wonder, what would it look like now? And 2009 was a long time ago, and those were teenagers. Like, what happens to adults? I would say for myself, I feel like it got more so as I got older, not lessened. How about you?
Would you say like more gender nonconforming
Yeah,
now?
I feel like I'm much
So
more gender nonconforming
I would
now.
say so. We've talked a bit about sort of neurodiversity and masculine related stuff, and I think my gender presentation went through an arc of deliberacy, where I would say I started out quite gender nonconforming, not in a sense that I was coming across as particularly masculine, but in the sense that, I sort of didn't engage in a lot of femme-coded activities or behaviors. And probably came across more as a bit of an alien, or like, like a very assertive young person with a lot of thoughts and who was not particularly attentive to her like appearance or whatever. And then as I figured out what was happening with other people's behavior and sort of clocked patterns of how people engage in social and sexual interaction, I constructed a way of performing my gender, right? That was more conventional, and then slowly kind of adjusted it in the same way that one might their fashion choices until I found a style of expression that suited me really well.
Ooh, I just remembered something else that's probably relevant to this conversation from that paper, which was that he found in it that straight boys who identified themselves as being perceived as very feminine on the scale were severely likely to be bullied. And so they weren't statistically more likely than gay boys who identify themselves as very feminine, but they were on par. And they actually, I mean, on the graph, they're higher, but it wasn't actually statistically significantly different. Which I think also speaks to the degree to which we expect so much overlap between gender and sexual identity. And I think some of it is like as we develop our identities as queer people, we kind of, I think, often consciously develop ourselves as being more gender nonconforming, and especially to say that we're gender nonconforming potentially in our own heads. And then we get perceived as more gender nonconforming just because we're attracted to people differently. But sometimes I think it's just because I can't understand straight worlds.
See, to me, like, I that doesnn't necessarily match my experience, which is that, like, I think, and again, this could have to do with a number of different things. I was not particularly socialized in a gendered way. In fact, I would say I was very much not socialized in a gendered way, and that played into an early sort of, I don't want to say off gender presentation, like, just an early obliviousness to the expectations of gender that led to gender nonconforming behavior, where I don't know that I necessarily would have cared if I thought about it, but I didn't think about it until well into my teens, I would say. And even then, really more my late teens.
I don't know if I ever really did think about my gender much until I got older. I mean, I also thought that I was straight, so it was less relevant I guess at that point, I mean, honestly, I thought I was straight. I think I was straight. I'm going to continue to be snarly
I
at
mean,
me.
I always knew I was bisexual.
Right.
But I was, as I say, right? Like if I had grown up now,
Yeah.
I would have said I was ace.
Right.
I would have said I was like, or maybe arrow,
Oh, interesting.
right? Because I mean, I remember very clearly when I was in high school telling people, like, I don't understand why people are so desperate to get laid and act weird about it, because like if I want to get off, I'll just masturbate. Which was like a perfectly natural thing for me to say that was true at that time. I was like, why put yourself through all of
Oh
this
my God.
in order to get touched by another person when I know how I like it myself, like, and as an adult, I have accustomed myself to the pleasures of human interaction,
Oh.
right? But in my teens, it wasn't wired up yet. And I only intermittently experienced like the types of attraction that we've described, particularly like the visual pop attraction was like I, there were people who I thought were hot, but I certainly didn't look at them and have a desire to have sex with them. And there were people who I was magnetically drawn to, but I didn't necessarily experience that as a desire to have sex with them. And yeah, and so I think the combo of not feeling particularly compelled to like lay out the honeypot for whoever I might be looking to hook up with, and having been not socialized in a particularly gender expectation-oriented way,
Yeah.
like led to some sort of casual gender nonconformity for me.
Yeah, I feel like for me, I was certainly when I was younger, I was very, very interested in the idea of sex, and I was never actually attracted to another person until I was 17, which confused and disappointed me in a lot of ways because I was like really interested in the idea of sex, but I was like, people? Dubious.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever would have identified as asexual though, just because I always was very enthusiastic about
I
the
liked sexual content. I was interested in
concept.
sexual themes. And like, I think something that also played into it for me, and this also has to do with my kinkiness, is that while I had sexual fantasies, and to this day have sexual fantasies, many of them do not include me.
Oh,
And
interesting.
so they are about
Yeah.
scenarios or different kinds of
Me too.
characters, right? And so the question of like, what is my desire? What about that scenario specifically, as oriented toward me, makes it compelling?
Yeah.
Is like actually something that I continue to unpack decades later, or whatever. And I do think it further complicated the question, at least for me.
Oh yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I've often thought about that for myself of like engaging in extensive sexual fantasies about characters, which I did a lot when I was a teenager and still do. It's as I've talked about someone talking about writing erotica, like that's a whole other level that a lot of this doesn't capture. It's like, well, but what if you're into the fantasy of this person? And like, sometimes you can agree both on what the fantasy version of them is. We've decided you have wings, and this is just all of our dirty talk from now on, right? Like, what does that look like in terms of constructing all of this? But yeah, I think ultimately the theme that we've really come to as we talked about this was just everything that we think we know about this seems to be based on some pretty massive oversimplifications in terms of what does gender look like, what does sexual attraction look like, and people's tendency to say, well, my situation is more complicated. Well, the answer is that's true for most of us, right? Nobody's actually that simple.
And I would say, to sort of add to that, my thought about that, right, is that the ways in which we simplify gender identity and sexual identity and attraction have a lot to do with the least common denominator of commonality required to figure out who does what side of social rituals, right? Where like there's all of these rituals of participation in society and in our culture, and someone's leading the dance and someone is following, or someone is, the goalie and someone is like a forward, whatever. I'm not a sports person, you know what I'm saying?
Pitcher and catcher.
Yeah, there you go. And I think that there's a broad variety of differently connoted, like complementary behaviors of these kinds, where the level that we reduce these to tends to be the level you need to know in order to engage in the right behavior.
Yeah, my husband's always joked about some of these things as mating plumage, just what some of it, some the sometimes gender, especially with reference to sexual orientation, can be mating plumage. Because I remember when I was younger, which I think it's probably less of a thing now, but I'm not sure. I was like, yeah, like all of my female friends, like they started identifying as bisexual and they pierced their noses. And I was like, what's up with that? And it's very cultural, right? I mentioned this to one of my grad school friends who was from India, and she was very confused and like sort of self-consciously playing with her nose ring. She's like, are people gonna think I'm gay? And I was like, no, I think we understand here in America that
Yeah,
that's just like
there's a little
normal,
more context,
right? There's a little more context to that. But like these things do come to have meaning, and so we understand that in the context of finding a partner. But then there's also, in addition to that, these social rituals that come along, and so it's like, oh well, if you're a woman, you must be a follow and dance. Like, but should I? Do I really have to be? I don't want to.
Exactly. It's, it's, and then learning how to construct, right, like these new rituals
Right.
based on like variations of like, does one have to be masculine to be dominant? And we've talked about that in the prior podcast that we did together,
But you think about flagging that type of thing. So my partner, Art of Fiction, who's been on this podcast, like he does a lot of dance, and he's a very submissive human being, and he goes to a lot of dance events, and he shows up with like a giant light up sign on him that says follow, because people just don't expect men to be follows.
Interesting.
And like, if you could imagine the rest of life providing you with such a flag, right? Like, how handy that would be. But the reality is that most of sex life isn't as simple as lead and follow, right? Even in kink land, it's often not that straightforward. And so, if you can imagine that simple thing becoming so much more like complex, and that I think is a lot of times our reality as we're trying to smash up, pun pun, like gender and sex and really sexual attraction and sexual orientation and sexual identity. There's like all these different elements coming together. And then on top of that, kink.
Oh man.
It's a wonder that some of us who have all of these things manage to find anyone we're attracted to at all. Which I think is how I managed to struggle with that for many years, because there just weren't many people who checked the right boxes.
I mean, when your cross section gets narrow enough, it can be tricky to
Can
find.
be very, very narrow.
And I would say the modern landscape has made that both easier and harder.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be backed up by the numbers. Well, I hope that this has given you some food for thought in terms of thinking about sexual attraction, gender, and all of this complicated mess. And thanks to Sugar and Poison for being a guest again in the
Thank you for having
show.
me.
And we'll be talking about some other stuff too, and hopefully do a series of episodes here. Thank you for listening.